Junk Food Cinema, a heavy metal journey into an urban hell where everything was done wrong. Welcome back to Junk Food Cinema. This is Brian.
And Cargill.
And we're still here. We have not been canceled yet. This is episode 2. We did it.
The dose.
The dose. The sophomore effort. We have not been yanked off the air yet.
And I can't wait till we get to episode 8 and we can just call it the Ocho.
The Ocho. Yes, because that's when we'll talk about movies nobody's heard of.
Yeah.
That'll be the one. That'll be the time we finally break that mold. So I want to take a moment. I feel like this is entirely appropriate to talk about ironic film appreciation and irony in general, because we do live in Austin, which is sort of a hive for the hipster crowd.
It is.
And I think there might be that, you know, when you hear about what this podcast is and it's like, oh, it's a bad movie podcast, you think of things like, you know, Mystery Science Theater or, you know, like late night movie marathons at various multiplexes. And there's a sense or a perception that maybe all of the love for movies like this is based on some sort of irony or is based on the so bad it's good model, which I, you know, to be entirely honest, I erroneously used as a model going, like when I first started Junk Food Cinema, as just to kind of explain it to people, like the so bad they're good. But I think that carries with it too much negative connotation.
It does, and it doesn't quite nail what we're talking about.
Right.
Because we're not talking about the movies that are so bad they're good. There are the occasional movies that are so bad they're good. And I used to, as a critic, I would do the worst of list every year, and I took the worst of list really seriously. In fact, I took it more seriously than I took my top 10 list, because so many people, so many critics, in particular, don't take a worst of list seriously and just put the top 10 films that annoyed them that year,
right,
or that they thought were disappointing, and call it a worst of list. And it's like, no, and I was always bothered because I was like, no, those aren't the worst movies of the year. How dare you say that this movie is the worst of the year in the year that this came out?
It almost seemed like they weren't in the trenches as much as some of the other critics. Like, there were films that they were just categorically ignoring because they didn't see them, because they knew how bad they were going to be, and then still putting together a worst of list that didn't include the movies that they ignored from the onset because of how bad they were going to be.
Well, and then there's that. Then you have those critics that feel that they're more advocates. Mm-hmm. You know, that advocate isn't even the right word, but they're activists, mm-hmm. and that they want to fight for better film, and better film means stuff that I like, not stuff that you may necessarily like. And so they'll put those films that are the types of films that they don't like at the top of their list to give a finger to the filmmaker and say, you could have done a better job making the movie I wanted to see. And that always bothered me. So I would put together the top 10 worst movies of the year, and I always save the 10th spot for the best bad movie of the year. Mm-hmm. Like a movie that is so bad that it belongs in the list, but is so, has its own entertainment value all its own.
Sure.
Movies like the recent Paul W.S. Anderson Three Musketeers made that list, mm-hmm. which is not a good movie at all. It's
no.
a terrible movie. And yet you can't help but have fun watching it because it's just so goofy and over the top. And then there's an entire sequence where they rip off The Matrix. And you're like, how do you rip off The Matrix in a Three Musketeers movie? But they do it. And you enjoy it on that level. There's other movies that I know several of us here in town really love this film, Standing Ovation, which is one of the worst things I've ever seen.
Yeah.
After Last Season is another truly unspeakably awful film that we've shown people or sat and watched more than once because it is so awful that it kind of blows the mind. But that's not what we're doing with Junk Food.
No, but let me ask you this question. Did you see a single person put Pacific Rim on their worst of list from last year?
I don't know. I didn't read any of the worst ofs.
I didn't see a single. And the reason you don't see a movie like Pacific Rim on the worst of list is because that movie is made purely and entirely for the spectacle of cinema. And I can appreciate that. And therefore, I can appreciate movies that it's not that it's so bad they're good situation, is that some movies create their own spectacle, and they create their spectacle in the glorious way that they sometimes fail at things, because sometimes it's a question of ambition. Like the things that a movie is trying to achieve without the appropriate resources, be they financial or talent based, you know, their reach outseating their grasp and so forth. But there's something admirable in that sometimes. So some of these movies that we're talking about that we kind of just, you know, refer to as so bad they're good because that's what people understand, what we're really saying is that they are really bad, but they're a spectacle all their own because of what they were trying to do and how they attempted to accomplish it. And a lot of times, like with movies like After Last Season or Troll 2, it's I'm fascinated by the stories of those movies and how they came to be made and what happened afterward. Like something that most people don't know about After Last Season, that is a movie that the producers actually asked theaters to burn the prints of, as opposed to pay to be shipped back to them.
Yes, there were four. They made four prints.
35mm prints.
Yeah,
by the way,
four prints to show around the country. And rather than having it shipped back, they just thought it was easier to have the prints burned. Yeah. We have a friend who's trying to track down a print, hoping that somebody didn't burn it.
But you look at a movie like After Last Season, as inexplicably bad as it is, it still made 35mm prints. Yeah. In an era when that's a dying format. Yeah. Like, to me, that's really interesting. And that's kind of what I'm latching onto. But you're right. If all you really cared about was nutritional value, you would never touch a Big Mac in your life. No. You would just never do it. But there are times when that is exactly what you're craving. That is what you want. And you can be well aware of the nutritional shortcomings of that Big Mac, but you still just purely enjoy the experience of shoving it into your gullet.
Fuck you. I'm going to watch Armageddon.
Yeah.
You know
exactly.
What? I want some Armageddon right now. It goes to something that you and I were talking about the other day. It's, you know, Tarantino said something very early on that really kind of connected with me. And he kind of parsed people out. He said there's two types of people in the world. There's mm-hmm. people who love movies and people who love the movies they love. And it's a really important distinction. Everybody thinks they love movies, and everybody says they love movies. Go on to any dating site and look up any profile, and every profile will say must love music and movies, love to sit on the couch and watch movies and go on long walks on the beach. You know, it's just one of those cliches that's there because everybody loves movies, except most people don't really love movies. They love the movies they love. They watch the same dozen movies over and over again. And the idea of watching something new that doesn't sound like it's bowled right up, you know, the center of their alley isn't something that they'll go out of their way to see, or an experience they're willing to give a chance to, until they've had somebody specifically tell them, dude, you have to see this. Yeah. Whereas film lovers, you know, are the types of people who go into everything wanting to love it and wanting to find a new gem and sifting through piles of stuff they've never seen, hoping to find that really cool, glorious movie.
And there is that sort of archaeological aspect to it as well. These movies that, you know, we keep referring to as lost. And no, we don't have to go into any ancient Aztec temple avoiding booby traps and whatnot in order to find them. But there is a search element to it. And there's, like, you know, a movie that you discover that you'd never heard of, and you start looking at the cast, you start looking at the plot description, you're like, okay, this sounds remarkable. I've got to check this out. But in terms of, you know, the movies that you love versus just the you know, people who love movies versus people who love the movies that they love, I don't understand loving movies sometimes as being a defining quality of someone. Because if you ever meet somebody who says definitively that they don't like movies, if you put the glasses on, formaldehyde face, that person is an alien. That person is clearly from another planet and is trying to lull you into sleep. So it's odd to me, and I think that quote is so telling and is so apropos of what this is. It's like, if you shut your brain off to this type of movie or that type of movie, and you only watch the movies that you're familiar with, you only watch the genres of films that you're familiar with, there's a whole world out there that you are shutting yourselves off to, and I think that's really sad.
Peter Weller was in town last year for the new Star Trek movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he said something that really hit him profoundly, that when he went back to school, because he went back to school to get his master's degree or his PhD, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be a PhD. And he teaches now. He teaches at Syracuse University. But one of his professors said something. He
teaches like Renaissance art, by the way.
Yeah.
Crazy.
And he had been making movies for years, and this professor just hit him with like a fist with this idea that when he said, you know, people say this phrase over and over again, I don't know art, but I know what I like. Mm-hmm. And they're wrong. They're lying to themselves. The truth is, you don't know art, but you like what you know. Mm-hmm. And typically people like the things that they're familiar with and don't try to embrace things that they're unfamiliar with. And as a result, they end up missing out on whole sections of art.
Sure.
And that plays into cinema. Sure, you know, people will watch the same types of movies over and over again and won't give other movies a shot, or give other types of movies a shot, because they'll see something that looks bad and go and just make a judgment call and go, oh, the rest of this is going to be awful. Mm-hmm. And they won't sift through it looking for what's great about it. And they won't try to find the magic that's beneath no budget or bad actors or a cramped time frame. And I think that's kind of the hallmark of what we would like to do with this, is to talk about those kinds of rare gems where people were aiming high and they were trying to put subtext in, and they were trying to be clever, and they were trying to do better than they had any budget or any talent supporting them for. And this is what came out. And finding those little bits of those little masterpieces.
Well, it's something I want to hit upon that, you know, was kind of a hallmark of the era that we most love in terms of B cinema, but continues to be an inspiration today, is the idea that you need limitations. You need these sort of impossible aims and impossible conditions in order to create the best stuff. I mean, we you know, talk about a movie like Battle Beyond the Stars. You talk about a lot of the Roger Corman movies where these filmmakers were challenged. They weren't given a lot to work with. They, you know, and they rose up, they rose to that challenge. And because of that, I mean, Martin Scorsese's first movie, Boxcar Bertha, is a great example of this to me. I mean, you have a guy who's working for Roger Corman and not given very much to work with, but makes a really sort of bitingly politically bitter sort of Southern girl gone bad railroad movie. And it's one nobody talks about from his canon. And it's because it's from this other era. Like, oh, it's the quote unquote bad movie he did. It's like, but the reason that movie excels is because he didn't have a lot. And you move into this common era. You look at somebody like Lord and Miller. Those guys are the ultimate representation of sometimes limitations are exactly what you need to create something spectacular.
Well, that's ultimately my disappointment with the movie Grindhouse. Mm-hmm. I've always felt that, you know, the problem with Grindhouse is that you've got two $25 million movies that are supposed to look like $2 million movies.
Yeah.
It's like, wait, you've got two geniuses like Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino. Why don't you give them $2 million and say, guys, go make the best goddamn movie you can make for $2 million.
Definitely.
Do it like that era, you know, shoestring it, stretch that money out as thin as you can, and turn in the best movie you can. Don't take money that you make your best movies with and try to make a bad movie.
Yeah.
Take bad movie money and make a great movie. And then that movie would have immediately profited. It would have made nothing but bank, and it would have turned out good films rather than what Tarantino holds to be his worst film and never to be duplicated.
You think Death Proof is his worst film?
Yes.
See, I like Death Proof. I don't like Planet Terror. I do enjoy Death Proof, but I completely agree with you. In fact, I was saying, I was having this discussion with someone, and I was like, I wish these guys that had come from nothing and really made something out of nothing were forced to go back and have those budgets again. And I think Robert Rodriguez is a great example of that. I mean, most people have this feeling about Robert Rodriguez that he was never as good as El Mariachi. And El Mariachi was a movie that he made for $7,000.
The
budget was $7,000.
Now, the budget was $7,000, but nobody's seen the $7,000 version.
That's true.
That movie cost $507,000, as they put $500,000 into color correction and new ADR, because his ADR was all done through cassette.
Yeah, and I mean, that being the case, yeah. I mean, even with that, $507,000 in this day and age, or even when that movie was made, is not a huge budget.
Yeah.
And I feel like there would be a lot more creativity. There would be a lot more remarkable films and memorable films coming out if, you know, money wasn't just thrown at the problem. But all of that kind of comes back to this idea that the movies that we're talking about, the movies that we love, that are considered, you know, by some critical benchmark or another to be a bad movie, we don't like them because they're bad. We're not liking them because, you know, it's well, nobody else likes them. We should like them. It's like, no. We genuinely love these movies. And that's kind of what bothers me about hipsterism, which I've always... Hipsterism to me is just an assumed appreciation. It's based on nothing but the status that it's perceived to carry with it. And that's kind of, the falsity is kind of my overall problem with it. I mean, for stop liking PBR because it assigns you to the too cool to care sect. Drink PBR because it's cheap and it's drinkable. There are times I go to Austin bars and I order a PBR and I feel like I shouldn't do it because people are going to think I'm a hipster. It's like, no, it's drinkable and it's cheap and I don't have a lot of money. So that's, sue me.
That's why we have Lone Star, my friend.
That's true. The national beer of Texas, which is like a half a stone's throw in the upward direction. But yeah, it's these movies that we're going to be talking about are not appreciated, ironically. I don't know. It's one of those things that I'm just excited to watch pretty much anything. Like any film that I've never seen before, any film that, especially one that either was made by somebody I respect or has actors in it I recognize or just has a over-the-top sounding plot, I'm excited to see these movies. I'm not going into it like, oh my God, this is going to be terrible. I have to get a bunch of friends together and laugh at how bad this movie is. Like, even the commentaries that we would do on oneofus.net, it's not about sitting around and making fun of the movie the whole time. It's about talking about what we genuinely like about it and some of the unique stories that come out of the productions of these films, which is the much greater appeal. I don't care about a status that, I mean, it's especially in Austin when you're surrounded by other people who like movies as much or even more than you do, you're not going to achieve any kind of status by liking bad movies. It's not going to benefit you in any way other than, you know, it's going to give you an opportunity to discover films that most people just wouldn't be able to recommend to you because they've forgotten about entirely.
Yeah, no, in this scene in particular, the only status is to be gained is to when you're the guy who shows up and goes, hey guys, I found something that you guys have never seen. Mm-hmm. Let me show you this.
Yeah.
And then kind of unleashing that on people and having them go, holy crap, how did I not know this exists?
Yeah.
How did I not know this movie was so good? And it's interesting to find those gems, and it's interesting having, you know, been a critic for so long, watching those gems that I saw in a theater as they came out, watch them kind of fall into the cracks and watch them get ignored, and trying to help people rediscover them and go, oh, how have you not seen this movie? And then watching and go, how is this not a hit? This movie's great.
Yeah, we haven't even hit upon the diamond in the rough situation, which is that you go through a lot of these movies, and sometimes there is joy and there is charm just kind of in the spectacle, but sometimes there are legitimately great movies that are just kind of assigned the same status as a real stinker because, you know, they're all like that. The most nebulous term is B movie. Like, what does that even mean? And it's one of those things that you can find so many legitimately great films if you're willing to sift through this stuff, if you're willing to take the time to make a commitment to viewing the stuff and to not have a lot of lofty standards and to not have prejudices against this type of film or that type of film. I mean, I'm an almost 30 white kid from Indiana, and one of my favorite genres of film is blaxploitation. Explain that one to me. I don't know.
Because you're a hipster.
God damn it.
I crossed that line.
You did. That's one. Everybody gets one.
Blaxploitation's so good, though.
It is good.
It was really. That's another one of those eras that was very much like this, in which what we were just talking about. In that, you know, everyone's like, oh, well, all of it, you know, Shaft kind of broke the mold, and it's like, whoa, you can have a black action hero. Well, let's have black everything. Let's make this stuff and tap into this market. And as they found out, holy crap. African Americans like going to the movies. They love movies, so let's give them what they want. And so they started throwing, you know, everything out there. And some people really worked very hard to prove themselves and churned out some really great work. There's lots of crap in there, but there's really great work. But you know, as we talked about, you know, you kind of got to sift through it, but that's what this podcast is about. We've done the sifting already. We have been sifting for years. This is what we do on the weekends.
Yeah.
We get together at each other's houses and just blow through stacks of stuff saying, hey, I've never seen this. Let's watch these things.
I'm glad you gave people a soundbite that they could go through and edit that has the words, we get together at each other's houses and blow. So I'm sure that won't come back to haunt us.
Yeah, no, we blow through movies.
that sentence alone could just be remixed and chopped and screwed into, we get together and blow each other.
Well, and see, now the thing is, they don't have to.
I just fucking said it. Yeah.
Now they don't have to.
I walked into that trap.
Yeah.
Sorry, Indy. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing is that we love these movies genuinely, and we're excited to talk about them. We're excited to share them with people because that's how we started, was, you know, getting together with people that we had met at the Draft House and just being like, have you seen this? Have you seen this? Oh, let's share this. Let's get together and watch this. And that's such a thrill, and it's such an awesome feeling of community that, I love these movies partially just because that, you know, it's a way for me to spend time with other really great people and talk about film and talk about the artists and talk about the stories. And I mean, you go back to Blaxploitation and the controversy with that being, you know, like there's the perception that it was a genre that was created specifically just to exploit African Americans. But the other side of that is you have a lot of African American actors, writers, directors, composers, people that wouldn't have gotten work at all in this time period if it weren't for these films. Like I said, don't expect us to be poking fun at these movies in a way that, you know, the only reason they're featured on the show is so that we can skewer them. That's not what this show's no. about. So if that's kind of why you decided to listen to this show, we're just warning you that that's really not what you're going to hear.
Yeah, one of the most exciting things about doing this was the fact that it gave me an excuse to sit down and revisit stuff.
Yes.
And to also watch some stuff. You know, you and I have already mentioned a couple of titles that we want to talk about, and they're things that each other hasn't seen.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, I've been meaning to sit down and watch that film for like 5 years, and I've never had an excuse. Here's my excuse to finally do that. So we'll be watching these along with you. The idea is that hopefully if things go to plan, we'll be posting a week in advance what films we'll be talking about the next week and where you can find them so that you can watch them and then you know, talk with us.
Yeah, join in on the discussion.
Be here and share your comments or see if we found stuff that you didn't find or vice versa.
Yeah, I relish the day that there are people in the comment section, have you seen this movie and neither one of us have even heard of it? And then it's a quick trip to I Love Video and boom, there it is. And so this is Junk Food Cinema. For better or for worse, we're going to be watching movies and I hope that you will join in with us. But for now, this Scotch is calling my name.
Yeah, I already finished mine, so I'm just back to the black coffee, so.
I guess I better catch up then.
All right.
Yo, this is Fred, the Hammer Williamson. If you're listening to Chunk Food Cinema with Brian and Cargill on Film School Rejects. You know what I'm saying? So keep on listening. You just might learn something later.
They trust no one. They fear nothing. 1990, the Bronx Warriors. They walk with death.
In the year 1990, the Bronx is officially declared no man's land. The authorities give up all attempts to restore law and order. From then on, the area is ruled, well, by us. You know what? We're taking over. Fuck it. We own the Bronx now.
We're the Riders?
We are the Riders. I mean, if you really think about it, what gang in this universe, in this movie, can we not take? I mean, seriously, whose ass could we not kick? These are some pretty wimpy gangs.
I don't know about that. There's some pretty tough post-apocalyptic gangs that have wiped out all the really tough gangs and just seem wimpy by comparison.
Well, we are talking today about 1990 Bronx Warriors. And as we have mentioned in the past, post-apocalyptic stuff is kind of one of our favorite little indulgences when it comes to the truly junkie of the junk food cinema.
You know, it's what all the kids these days call dystopian.
is it dystopian?
Dystopian. No. Yes, no. The Catching Fire is dystopian cinema. No, I mean, you know, all this dystopian cinema has its roots in this really great, you know, post-apocalyptic era. Mm-hmm. That we had in cinema of the late 70s, early 80s, which was all stemming from, you know, it's a generation of kids who grew up under the threat of the bomb and of nuclear holocaust and started wondering what a nuclear holocaust future would be. And there had been a couple of really good ones done before that. You know, I think one of the greatest post-apocalyptic films ever made is the based on the Harlan Ellison story, you know, Boy and His Dog. And we'll talk about that sometime in a future episode. But that spawned a whole, you know, series of really great post-apocalyptic films, which brings us to the Italians.
Oh, the Italians.
We love the Italians.
Their disregard for copyright infringement is epic. They would basically look at what was popular in America. They would look at films like John Carpenter's Escape from New York. They would look at films like even Australia's Mad Max and Road Warrior because those movies were selling big in America. They would look at films like Walter Hill's The Warriors and say, you know what? We can do that, but cheaper.
Well, and, you know, the most famous of these is we know as Zombie.
Yes.
Or Zombie 2, as it's known in Italy, because the first Zombie was Dawn of the Dead. Mm-hmm. And they had the rights to the title in Italy, so they made Zombie 2, which was Fulci making his own, you know, zombie film.
And then they tried to sell it as a sequel to Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, but not over here. It was just known as Zombie, but over in Italy, it was a zombie sequel to Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah.
But so what they would often do is sometimes they would make, you know, just rip-offs like that. But sometimes, just sometimes, they would make mashups. And they would make some of the greatest mashups known to man. As we talked about earlier, you know how one of Brian and I's first experience bonding was me showing him After the Fall of New York, which was a mashup of Escape from New York and a number of other strange films, including Planet of the Apes. Which is just fucking weird. But that leads us to another one of our favorites, one of our shared favorites, which is 1990s Bronx Warrior, which is a mashup of Escape from New York and The Warriors.
Definitely.
And it is a post-apocalyptic film about New York being completely overrun by gangs that all dress up differently and are all weird, and some of which are blatant knockoffs of the Warriors gangs, and others just aren't. Some are weird. And it's got this
– Some are weird. Just a few of them are weird.
Are just fucking weird. It's a weird, quirky, strange film that doesn't entirely work and yet is entirely lovable for that fact.
And yet is a product of one of the most bizarre eras in filmdom, this early 80s surge in Italian genre films.
Yeah.
And not only Italian genre films, but Italian genre films that were sort of the precursor to what we know now as like The Asylum.
Yeah.
Where the entire purpose of making the film was to try and trick people into paying to see it, thinking they were seeing something else.
But the difference between them and the Asylum is the Asylum likes to goof on those films and kind of makes parodies of those films in a certain vein, and they don't take their movies seriously. Many of the Italians took these very seriously, and probably one of the chief amongst those guys was the director of this film, Enzo G. Castellari, who you guys probably know his filmography best as being the director of The Inglourious Basterds.
The original.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, The Inglourious Basterds.
The Inglourious Basterds.
Which is, you know,
spelled correctly.
Yeah, and Tarantino went and made Inglourious Basterds, which was a send-up of The Inglourious Basterds. But The Inglourious Basterds was a Dirty Dozen ripoff and a really kind of good one. One of the hallmarks of Castellari's films is he would, he was hiring a bunch of American actors. One of them in all of these films, in all of his films from this era, including this one, the Inglourious Basterds, and is it Warlords? Exterminators of the
– No. Warriors of the Wasteland.
Well, Warriors of the Wasteland is one title. The other is Exterminators of the Year 3000. It's the two titles of the same movie. And oftentimes we get them mixed up because it's hard to tell if these are different movies or just the same
movie. It's so hard to tell that you're actually incorrect. Exterminators, are you sure? Yes, I am.
I was just looking at it earlier and seeing it listed under both titles.
Warriors of the Wasteland, its alternate title is The New Barbarians. So that's the etymology of those two movies.
Now, what is it? Who did Exterminators from the Year 3000? Isn't that also Castellari?
Exterminators of the Year 3000 is the one that is just blatantly the Road Warrior, like the most blatant Road Warrior ripoff of this entire era. But Exterminators of the Year 3000 is also called,
because I was just looking at a poster that had both titles on it. So
it's also
probably
called Death Warriors. And Exterminator is Death Warriors and Exterminators in the Year 3000. Those are the alternate titles of Exterminators of the Year 3000. But this is
who did was that Castellari as well? Though?
It was not Castellari. Giuliano Carneimo. I can't pronounce it. But that's the only reason I bring that up. Not to like call you out on it. But it's such a great illustration of the problem we run into being fans of this genre. Is these things are released under five different titles and they all use about six different words.
And a lot of it is confused in its own stuff.
Yes.
And a lot of people like I was. you know, looking it up because I wanted to watch the trailer for that one because I was like, I know I've seen this one, but I always get it mixed up with another one. So which one is it? And sure enough, it had both those titles. I was like, wait, I thought those were two different. Oh, I guess I was wrong. But no, I was initially right and was wrong when I was recorded. So that's how that works. So
that is the nature of podcasting.
And it's also the nature of Italian cinema. Indeed. Which is just, but so this one is probably one of the best mashups. Mm-hmm. From this era. Yeah. As much as we love After the Fall of New York.
This is both the technically best and I think the most entertaining of any of the Italian post-apocalyptic films.
Well, it's technically best, I think, is a great way to put that because it is – this film is shot so well.
It really is.
It's so pretty. It's so – you know, Castellari clearly looked at the cinematography of the Warriors and of John Carpenter's work in Escape from New York and tried to make a film every bit as good as those.
Yeah.
And he didn't because both of those films are classics. But what he did make is a really great – karaoke riff on those movies.
Yeah. And so the basic plot here, for those of you, I'm hazarding there might be a few of you who haven't seen this movie.
Just a handful.
So the basic story is that, you know, it's 1990 and something has happened, though they never really go into what exactly happened. They've just given up on the Bronx. As a borough of New York, they've completely given up any hope of maintaining control and declared a no man's land and gangs take over. And that's where we begin. But the story centers around this young girl who, just before her 18th birthday, runs away from Manhattan to the Bronx because she is apparently going to be inheriting control of the Manhattan Corporation. So if you're not getting a sense already that there's some, like, undertones of class warfare going on, that not only is the Bronx this place where only gangs are and people have given up on it, but Manhattan is incorporated. Manhattan is a giant corporate machine now. So she runs away and into the arms of Trash, who is the leader of the Riders. They are the top gang in the Bronx. Trash, man, I guess that's where we should probably begin this discussion. So Trash is played by an actor by the name of Mark Gregory, and I say that, but his name is not actually Mark Gregory. That is one of the great things about Italian cinema, is they would change actors' Italian names to make them, you know, to basically Americanize them. And Mark Gregory's real name is Marco Di Gregorio, who was 17 years old when they filmed the movie and was discovered at a gym.
Yeah, he was literally working out in the gym and... And the director's like, I love your look. We have to put you in the movie, which will lead to another aspect of the story we will talk about shortly. Because Trash, the amazing thing about Trash is not only is he your typical tough gang type character, he has the craziest walk in the history of film, short of Monty Python's Ministry of Silly Walks.
You know, it's not often that we talk about the posture of a film hero as a major defining quality, but the spinal rigidity of young Trash is something to behold.
It's okay. You know what? We're just going to jump.
Let's just do it. Let's go right into that.
This is how crazy this movie is. So as Fred Williamson talked about in, who is also in this movie, Fred,
yes.
The Hammer
Williamson.
Yo, Brian, this is the Hammer.
Oh my God. Like I got tingles when I heard him like, I'm sorry, you're going to do a bumper for our show. You're going to endorse Junk Food Cinema, the podcast. Like that right out of the gate is like doing a baseball podcast and getting Babe Ruth.
But I love the fact that he called you and was like, hey, Brian, this is the Hammer. Like, that's his
name.
Not like, this is Fred Williamson. You know, my agent said you wanted it. It's like, this is the Hammer. You know I'm calling.
Yeah. You were expecting my call in the middle of the day. I was like, oh my God, it's Fred Williamson.
And the Hammer is in many of Enzo's movies. Mm-hmm. But he tells the story about how, you know, Mark Gregory was discovered in the, in this gym, but I'm quoting Fred the Hammer Williamson here, he was so light on his feet, he wouldn't leave prints in the snow. Which was the very, very careful way of saying he was very gay, very effeminate, and he didn't know how to walk like a man. And yeah. So the director was like, look, you can't walk like this. You're an action hero. This is how you walk. And so he taught him kind of to walk with swagger, and Mark Gregory never quite got it.
Which is evident by the final product, the film.
In fact, there's a sequel to this movie that we watched.
Escape from the Bronx.
Escape from the Bronx, which is disappointing because someone had finally taught Trash how to walk.
Yeah.
And Mark Gregory is, you know, reprises his role and walks around like a normal human being. It's like, where's the Trash walk? The Trash walk is kind of...
Well, and that's the important distinction we need to make here. His walk is not a product... It's not just a product of him being gay. There is something otherworldly about the way that he walks.
No, it's not him being gay. It's him trying to emote something else. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how the director tried to show him how to walk, but the
showed him footage of proud baby giraffes.
The combination of it turned into this stiff, arms out, fists held, like weird, like everywhere he walks.
He looks like a Slender Man in leather.
No, he looks like an 8-bit character from Nintendo back in the 80s. Like there's no range of movement on this guy whatsoever. It's like, turn. And it's just such a weird thing that it's the defining element of this. You're hearing us talk about this, and until you've actually watched it yourself and seen it with your own eyes, you can't understand the magic of the Trash walk.
Mark Gregory is literally a walking contradiction. That is everything that is Mark Gregory. And he is one of the most effeminate bikers you will see this side of a leather bar. And don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting there would have been thing wrong with his character being gay, but he's sold to us as exactly the opposite, as an exaggeratedly macho ladies man, as an action hero, as you said. And it's a strange paradox that they give him these lines of dialogues just dripping with New York bravado, like, I'm gonna knock you. He literally says at one point, I'm gonna knock your block off. He says that, and he's not like a member of Fagin's Pickpockets, and he says this, which is so crazy to me. And then he also has a line where he says, this could be a pile of shit out of someone's asshole. And it's just like, who is telling you that this is how tough guys talk? But then they also give him like flowery diatribes about the meaning of life. Just listen to the shit that he says in the movie.
We were born dead. Life means nothing. We live with death every single day. Death walks with us. Death rides and sleeps with us. We carry its smell under our skins.
So that, I mean, that should give you an indication. Like, I can't nail down exactly what this character is. And that enigma kind of makes him very appealing, and I can't quite explain it, but
it's one of those weird quirks. This movie's full of a lot of these weird quirks of things that isolated by themselves are hilarious and don't work, but ultimately create this overall sense of a very bizarre world gone mad.
That's
what's so interesting, and what works about this film is almost an accidental, you know, that's why we love the tagline of this, you know, where everything is done wrong. And it's like, this movie does so much wrong, and yet for some reason it all gels together to create this really absurd post-apocalyptic world that you really feel is its own beast.
Yeah.
And everything is so weird, and like right down to, you know, the opening shots of the film. This film, like we said, is shot so gorgeously. The opening shots of this film, you know, when, you know, we've got this girl getting chased through New York, and then all of a sudden the riders show up. And they're on these motorcycles with these little plastic lighted skulls on the tops, because that shit looks cool, right?
Well, because it was the day after Halloween and Walmart was having a sale.
They were having a sale. It's exactly those kinds of things. It's like exactly what you'd find on sale after Dios de los Muertos. And they're those skulls. And now that I put that image in your mind, you watch, you're like, holy shit, that's exactly what they are. But it's kind of goofy. And at the same time, all of them have it in that way that when a bunch of people do something crazy, it looks kind of cool. And it looks kind of cool. And this movie just really sets up this bizarro world of post-apocalyptic New York.
But you're right. They take such ownership of it, even within the tagline. It's not an apology when they say everything is done wrong. They're telling you right off the bat, there are things about this world that are going to make no sense to you because you don't fucking live there.
Yeah.
You don't live in the Bronx past this apocalypse, even though we have not mentioned, or do we mention at any point during the film, what caused the apocalypse? It's very much like Escape from New York, where it's not really an apocalypse so much as it's just
dystopia.
It's dystopia. It's gotten to, like, crime has risen to a point where society has just given up. There's no war. There's no atomic bomb that goes off. There's no virus that turns people into zombies. It's just apathy. It's just we're done with this part of the country.
It's interesting. And the reason there's this small era, the small pocket of time where these movies existed and where this feeling existed. And the production value of these films are so great. And the reason is it's all tied together in that sections of New York were literally crumbling to dust. The buildings were old. People weren't living there. They were being condemned. They were being knocked down. People hadn't really bought into the idea that New York was salvageable. You know, Times Square was a total mess. But this is where, you know, Rudy Giuliani comes into the story. You know, Rudy Giuliani came in and said, I'm going to clean up New York. And he became what many people believe to be, you know, one of the more fascist right-wing mayors of New York in history. But he did exactly what he set out to do. He cleaned up Times Square and turned it into, you know, glitz and glam and you know, the Today Show. And he turned it into what now New Yorkers are complaining that it's turning into a city, an island of millionaires, where you can't live in New York without being rich. And they've rebuilt all of these buildings. You know, they've torn them down. And this is in that weird pocket of era where they hadn't yet rebuilt. And there were entire sections of the city where you could walk through, and it was walking through a demilitarized zone. It was walking through a post-apocalyptic future. And there was this sense that maybe New York was never going to be what it was again. Maybe this was the fall of Rome. Maybe we were seeing the end of society as we know it before it evolved into something else. And we abandoned these sections of New York to where the poor and the listless and the gangs would live. And that this that it would just become an unregulated hellhole because we didn't clean it up. Yeah. And this is what could happen. And it didn't happen. We ended up cleaning up New York, and we did it. Brian. Yeah, that was a rough weekend.
I got blisters all over my hands from those brooms. I'm telling you.
You know, we put up a couple of fences, a new fresh coat of paint, a couple of skyscrapers, and bam, New York is back, baby.
And all the filth was washed away.
All washed away. But this is in that era where you could, you know, you have a whole series of movies where you could go, and you have movies like Street Trash. You have movies like Escape from New York that were shot on location in New York because these places really exist. There really were these buildings crumbling that in this day and age, you look back and go, do you know how much that property is worth? Why didn't somebody build that? It's because they didn't have faith. They didn't believe that it was going to become what it is now.
And you have this Italian director who accidentally, by virtue of mimicking a movie that was already successful, making a pretty astute social statement about the condition of New York City.
Yeah.
And that to me is what's so fascinating about movies like this. And I'm glad you brought that up because one of my favorite things about movies from the late 70s, early 80s that are set in New York, where especially the movies that don't acquire the quote unquote proper permits to shoot. So they're just shooting like on the street, especially on 42nd Street. You can just see like caked on stench on every side.
I believe it's semen.
It might be semen, but you can almost smell it through the screen. You can almost smell the filth rising up right off of the city streets because at that time, New York was a pretty filthy place. And you're right. That's kind of what gave rise to Carpenter's dystopian vision of New York in the distant future of 1997. And then a couple years later, here comes Enzo Castellari to say, no, I don't think we're going to make it to 97. It's going to be 1990. It's going to be 7 years from now.
What year was this movie made? Because I think it wasn't a few years. I think it was like almost right after.
Well, the thing about it is it was made like in 1981. It was shot in 1981, but it wasn't released until 1983.
Okay.
So you're right. Like production-wise, it started up immediately. As soon as they saw money coming into Carpenter, oh, we got to do that. But it took until 1983 for the movie to actually be released, which is an interesting – I'm not sure exactly what caused the delay there, but –
But so the basic premise of this movie, going back to talking about that, is, you know, they're taking this girl across the Bronx, and it becomes a very Warriors kind of thing where they're encountering all these other gangs that are trying to take them out. And then it just goes into this brilliantly beautiful, nonsensical almost plot of action scene after action scene, shot so beautifully.
Shot very well. And Castellari almost understands what made the Warriors great. He is so, so close. I mean, he gets that the audience has really dug colorful and compartmentally specialized gangs. Like, you have this turf and you have these costumes and you're united under this theme and this concept. But he whiffs, in my opinion, he whiffs on the element of the various gangs and the Warriors. They were all, you know, almost to the number badasses. And yet, where the Warriors has the baseball furies, Bronx Warriors has the Bob Fosse experience. I don't know what else to call the gang of tap dancers with studded, like, bolo hats and canes, and it's just like,
I didn't think that was I wouldn't compare them to the Bronx Bombers. They reminded me of the Mime Gang from the Warriors.
I mean
in the opening scenes where they've got the Mime Gang. You know, one of the great things about the Warriors is the Warriors is another great whiff of cinema history, in which, you know, it was one of those movies where somebody was taking a look into the future and zigged when they should have zagged. And they took the 70s. In the 70s, there was the disco sensibilities of individuality and of kind of an ostentatious way of expressing yourself, which people assumed would continue and explode. And that's how you get movies like The Apple and The Warriors that show these futures where everybody is, you know, glitzed and glammed up and making themselves look as amazing as possible, not realizing that what we would enter into is, you know, a more conservative era of Austin. Austerity and where everything would kind of normalize, and what would become cool is the yuppies and the suburban experience. And so he assumed that, they assumed, Walter Hill assumed in making that movie, that we were going to enter this future that's like this. And instead, you know, we get something different. And his future was, you know, a few years down the road in which every gang took its own identity and went as crazy silly as possible, mm-hmm. as opposed to actually there becoming a certain conformity. Where, you know, what we ended up with in the 80s and 90s were gangs that looked identical except for the color of scarf they were wearing.
Definitely.
And, you know, the only difference between the Bloods and the Crips
was red versus blue.
Red versus blue.
Which is funny that there is now a geek property called – every time I hear red versus blue, I don't think of Halo. I think of gangster rap from the 90s.
And West Side and, you know, Coast.
Every time you do that, we get several shades wider. We're pretty much clear by now.
We are transparent. you know, it's not, you know, it's not quite your rendition of, you know, Nate Dogg.
The Regulators.
Regulators.
I do love to do that song at karaoke.
You and Luke, baby. So this has that sensibility of, like, you know, that was ripping off Walter Hill and was very much like, fuck it. These gangs are just going to be fucking silly.
Yeah, there is literally a gang in this movie called the Scavengers who look like zombies. And there is a gang called the Zombies who look like they scavenge their uniforms from various skating rink dumpsters. They're wearing, like, pillow shams and roller skates, and they have hockey sticks and spray-painted white Nazi helmets. It's like, what the fuck is this?
Well, it's almost like he knew what he was ripping off. But he didn't want to quite rip it off. He wanted to do his own take on it. I mean, the movie clearly wants you to think of the Warriors. The opening shots of this film are these wonderfully executed, well-lit close-ups of, like, faces getting makeup on it and of a roller skate.
With just a black backdrop.
Just a black backdrop. And it's like, oh, by the way, you're watching the Warriors right now. Oh, remember the Warriors?
Listen to the damn score in the opening. It could not be more similar to the music that Joel Walsh did for the Warriors.
Yeah.
It's crazy to me. But yeah, this is a film. One of the craziest parts about this film, and I understand the reason. I'm not lost as to the reason they did this. But if you think about Escape from New York and you think about the Warriors, the one thing they have in common, apart from being in New York, is that all of the action of those movies, almost every single scene, takes place at night. Every single scene takes place at night.
The other thing they have in common is they're both movies about traveling across New York.
Well, yeah.
Dystopian future.
The New York thing, sure. Yeah,
and gangs.
But yes, there are other things. Shut up. I'm making a point. But the 1990 Bronx Warriors, everything takes place during the day. There is one night shot, and it's not even night. It's the sun rising at the very beginning of the movie where the young heroine is escaping Manhattan and going into the Bronx. From that point forward, it is a daylight all the time. It is nothing but daylight. And I think it's interesting that he is mashing up and ripping off two movies that both take place almost wholesale at night, and yet the entire movie takes place during the day, which makes it kind of interesting that all this, it kind of reinforces the idea of how seedy these places are, that all this shit's going on in broad daylight. Now, of course, it was probably a budgetary thing. Like, if it's daylight, we don't have to light up. We don't have to light the sets.
But there, you know, I want to think that, but then there's part of me that looks at Castellari's record, and Castellari, it, you know, there's, there, it's like what we were talking about in last week's episode about, Battle Beyond the Stars, mm-hmm. where you have these guys who know what they're making, but just try to make something better. And Castellari has always struck me as somebody who was trying to make, he had the money to make these knockoff films and then was like, well, we'll do this and this will be different and this will set it apart. And the film that is most like is Mad Max. And then of course Road Warrior and in which, you know, those movies take place primarily in the day.
True.
And are, have this well lit dystopia.
They take place on a good day. yeah, I said it. No. Bing.
Oh, Brian.
Every week I try to give you a reason to quit the show and then see if you'll stay.
You're doing a good job. No, but so I can't help but think that was one of those things where he's like, well, we're ripping off this movie and then we're ripping off this movie. How do we make it different? Oh, well, you know what's different? Neither of those movies had great scenes during the day. And so let's shoot a movie that takes place a day. And hey, by the way, it also means we don't have to set up these lighting rigs and pay for the generators mm-hmm. and do all that. Well, you know, cause they still had lights and generators, but they didn't need, you know, to do it as much.
So finding a substance out of logistics.
Yeah. And that's what also makes this film look different than other films. The only film that I can really compare this to visually is Street Trash.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Which was shot several years later in that same crumbling area of New York. Of which, you know, the most famous person to come out of Street Trash is Bryan Singer, who was a PA on that film. interestingly enough. But yeah, but it has its own feel so that you can watch this movie knowing that it's a knockoff of these two other films and yet get a completely different experience out of it.
Well, and it should be noted that the cinematographer on this film is Sergio Salvati, who did pretty much all of Fulci's stuff. He did Zombie. He did City of the Living Dead. He did The Beyond.
I love City of the Living Dead.
These are movies that we love specifically for the visual aesthetic of them. I mean, the gore stuff, absolutely, and there's cheesy stuff in them we love too. But those movies, Fulci movies, look a certain way. There's a very distinct visual signature behind a Fulci film, and it lends so much to 1990 Bronx Warriors to have Sergio Salvati. So I will – you know what? Knowing that, I will kind of bend a little bit. Maybe it wasn't just a matter of it's cheaper to shoot in the daylight. We do have a talented cinematographer. We have a cinematographer who's been established within genre, within Italian genre. So it's just very interesting, all the little elements that come together to make this weird hodgepodge of a film.
Yeah. And so I'm I absolutely love the look of this film. And it just feels like its own thing. And And it's good in its own right, so much so that there's a crappy sequel, and you and I just don't really like the sequel. We watched it for the first time together. You brought it over. They're like, I found it. I have it on DVD. I'm like, let's pop it in. And you, me, and Luke sat down and watched it. We're like, oh, this is a letdown. It's not really as – it's not nearly as good and not nearly as bad in, like, in all the ways that came together for that first film. It was just – I was like, oh – okay.
Well, they extracted so much that made the first one good and replaced it with more flamethrowers. That was it. Like, that was the big thing about the sequels. It was just more flamethrowers than were in the original, which if you're not familiar with Italian post-apocalyptic cinema, there's always flamethrowers. Yeah. It is their favorite weapon by far.
It's cheap and it's sexy. And although I will say that the second film has the cooler actor as a villain.
Oh God, who's the villain in the second one?
I'm gonna wait for the look on your face.
Oh God, I should know this.
And you really should know this.
Oh God, it's Henry Silva.
Yes,
of course it is.
It's Henry Silva.
Henry Silva is a guy who will probably end up getting his own show dedicated to him in the future
because we love Henry Silva.
Because Henry Silva is amazing. But one of the things about 1990 Bronx Warriors that really always made me laugh, and I didn't know this until I watched it a second time with. My friend Luke Mullen, who spent a lot of time in New York City, there is a scene. There are actually several scenes of sort of a place where the various gangs converge. It's almost like neutral ground where they have a lot of meetings and they discuss things. And there's this random drummer. He just sits there drumming.
Yeah.
Like very upbeat jazz. The whole time there's this meeting going on. Nobody talks to him. Nobody explains why he's there. He's almost like this weird, like – jazz version of a Greek chorus, just the whole thing.
And they keep showing the shot where they're meeting in the Bronx and they're having discussions. And then across the waterway, you can see the Twin Towers. You can see Manhattan. The second time I watched it with Luke, he goes, based on where they are, that's not the Bronx. You can't see that from the Bronx. They're in Brooklyn. So it's funny to me that at a certain point in the movie, they really like hit you over and over again with this one location that they were so proud of. And it's definitely not in the Bronx.
Well, because, it makes me laugh. Because the Bronx is a war zone, and the only place you can go to talk privately is Brooklyn.
Brooklyn.
Bam! Mic drop. We're done. I've explained the logic of...
There can never just be an inaccuracy in these movies. There's always a purpose behind it.
You know what? Sometimes it's really true that it is there. But the thing, you know, that's something, you know, we haven't really touched on or talked about. But that's something that I love doing with films is rather than, you know, I think that's often one of the mistakes a lot of critics make is if they see something that's inconsistent, they assume it's wrong and they don't try to figure out why it might be right first. Now, what I'm pretty sure was bullshit.
Yeah, you did bullshit.
That was total bullshit.
But you have several years under your belt of spinning bullshit. You're like a bullshit Jedi at this point.
What? Jedi?
He's no Jedi.
He's no Jedi. But a lot of times, you know, they're really, you do have these smart people making these films. And, you know, it was no accident that Planet Akir was called Planet Akir in Battle Beyond the Stars. No, that was John Sayles being smarter than the audience he was writing for. And I have a feeling that, you know, a lot of these films, they really do have these things where there is logic there, but the scene that explains the logic got cut, or the director didn't understand it, so he threw out that line of dialogue, or, you know, that there is logic to it. Sometimes it is just fuck it. You know, nobody's going to care. This movie's going to show as the third movie at a drive-in. Yeah. You know, it's going to be, you know, half the audience is going to be asleep.
Only these two idiots in Austin are going to care about it.
Someday in the future, there'll be some guys in Austin, Texas who love it. And I can't even take full credit for being, you know, we're not the only two guys.
No, totally.
I know Lars Nielsen. I learned about this from Lars Nielsen, who is one of the local, junk food cinema gurus. The guy is a fucking Jedi master of fucking cinema and knows how to find everything. And he, at one of the early Fantastic Fests, I believe it was the second one, programmed a post-apocalyptic series. And this was of him. And that's how I found out about this film, was he found a 35mm print that nobody thought existed. And he found it and he showed it. And I saw this on a beautiful 35. And it was just so amazing. And it was just something that, you know, you're laughing about the walk and you're laughing about some of the dialogue and about classic Italian dubbing. Where what the Italians would often do is, most often do, is they wouldn't record the sound at all. And they would then ADR it for whatever language it was in. So even if the film like this was shot entirely in English and spoken by English-speaking actors, they would still be dubbed later.
Yeah.
And so it has this weird otherworldly quality to it. And even if you're giggling about that, there's still so much here that works.
Definitely. And one of the things that really works is sort of the casting of the antagonists for our hero Trash. One of which is, as we mentioned before, Fred the Hammer Williamson.
The Hammer!
The Hammer! Playing a character who is not named the Hammer, despite the fact that there is a character in the movie...
Named Hammer, actually. Not the Hammer, yeah, but just Hammer. Named Hammer. Vic Morrow plays Hammer.
Vic Morrow is amazing. Don't get me wrong. But how bad a casting flub is that? You have a character called Hammer. You have an actor you're going to cast in the movie who's... Fred the Hammer Williamson, but you name him, you give him the character named Ogre, who throughout the movie, because of the dubbing, this is specifically because of the dubbing, I kept thinking they were saying his character's name was Yogurt, which I was like, is this Spaceballs? What is going on here? But Fred the Hammer Williamson plays the Ogre, who is sort of like the Duke in Escape from New York. In fact,
sort of.
He's entirely the Duke.
He's the Duke.
He's A number one, the Duke. Yeah. But he calls himself the king or the emperor of the Bronx. I can't remember his exact terminology, but it's very much like the Duke in Escape from New York. And he is the leader of the gang called the Tigers. Now, how to describe – this is one of the things about Enzo Castellari's version of the Warriors that is really remarkable, is that even within the different gangs, there need be no uniformity of concept. At one point, when we go to Ogre's lair, holy God, it's like Liberace's nightmare. There's, I don't even know how to exactly put it. There's like people wearing these big flowery, like zoot suits, like they're funk gangsters. And then there's this giant stark white grand piano. And there's a woman who's dressed like a She-Ra-esque dominatrix. And then there's a guy with blue face paint, even over his beard, playing the bongos. It's a fever dream.
Yeah.
It's like, you're not bound by one concept for this gang.
But again, that goes back to what I was talking about is that his view of this fallen Bronx is that it really is just kind of a place for the insane, and that everything is just the whim of these power mad, insane people who would live in this wasteland.
Yeah.
And that's a hallmark of this era of filmmaking that you just don't, you really don't get to see. You see little bits of that every once in a while in dystopian film. You know, you'll end up in the one place that's just kind of weird. But that, I think this all very much borrows from what I was mentioning earlier, Harlan Ellison and his film A Boy and His Dog, which has several, A Boy and His Dog is just such a weird, strange dystopian story. Mm-hmm. Have you seen A Boy and His Dog?
I have not seen A Boy and His Dog.
Okay, so for those of you not familiar with it, it's the premise is it's in this post-apocalyptic, I'm pretty sure post-nuclear Holocaust world in which dogs have developed telepathy. And dogs can sense women. And women have become rare. Women have mostly died off. And so they're very rare. And this guy, played by a young
Don Johnson,
is wandering the wasteland looking for women to fuck, and is using this telepathic dog, and he feeds the dog and protects the dog and keeps the dog fed. And as part of the deal, the dog, who he's in mental contact with, takes him around and helps him find women to get laid with.
The full title of the movie, to be fair, is A Boy and His Dog, an R-rated, rather kinky tale of survival. So that should give you an indication of what's going on here.
Is that really one of the titles?
Yeah, that's its full title.
Because I've only seen it, even the credits in the film are A Boy and His Dog.
Yep.
But it is such a brilliantly absurd piece of fiction. I mean, Harlan Ellison's one of my favorite writers. He's just a fucking genius madman. And that story, that weird post-apocalyptic future, really, I feel, informed, the stuff that then came 10 years later. And everybody was kind of aping that in one way, shape, or form. And this movie goes more absurd than any other film that I can think of. Because Carpenter was clearly borrowing from that, because there's so much absurdity and strangeness in Escape from New York.
You look at the guy that comes out of the sewer with the finger, with the hair that's 8 feet tall. Yeah, there's a lot of absurd stuff going on in Escape from New York.
And then you look at Carpenter's Escape from Law.
Escape from Law?
Escape from Law, because we refuse to call it Escape from LA.
Right on.
It's Escape from Law, which is not a great film, as much
not
as we love Carpenter.
In any regard whatsoever.
He went, and the problem with that film is he went too absurd. And he went too absurd in to a level that even makes Castellari go, oh, no. that is too silly.
You did not have enough flamethrowers.
Where are the flamethrowers? More flame! I kind of want to see Michael Bay's version now. More fucking flame! More flamethrowers. Come on. Make it bigger. But
I just love thinking of Enzo Castellari as the precursor to Michael Bay.
Am I wrong?
You're not wrong, except I actually think Enzo Castellari is more of an artist. I don't know. Maybe that's just me.
I disagree. We'll do our conversation on Michael Bay at some point. Because Michael Bay, what nobody brings about the artistry of mayhem like Michael Bay. Like
that I will give you.
Say what you will about his storytelling. Say what you will about his character work.
But, I usually do, yeah.
But nobody blows shit up or creates car chases like fucking Michael Bay.
It's true.
Pure art. And that's a lot of what you see here. Castellari really, really milks the weird and strangeness out of these films. And Fred the Hammer Williamson, as we were just talking about, as Ogre. Is just so fucking weird in a way that it's like, remember how weird the Duke was? Yeah, fuck that.
Hey, number one. Well, the thing is, you will see Fred the Hammer Williamson, and as we mentioned before, in a lot of these post-apocalyptic movies in the 80s. And, I had a chance to talk to him, and I asked him about that, and he was telling me that they were setting him up to be the new Woody Strode. who in Italy was like the top black actor, but was getting up there in years. But the thing that we didn't touch on, I had to do a little research, but the reason that Fred Williamson was in Rome to begin with was he got really sick and tired of his movies doing really well internationally, but the rights being licensed for next to nothing. So he wasn't making any money, even though all these foreign distributors were, you know, making bank off of his films. So he moved to Rome to basically be the place where the buck stopped. Like, if you want Bucktown, this is where the buck stops. And so he went to Rome.
That's exactly what he said.
No, that's just what I made up just now.
I wish.
Right? That should be on a plaque on his desk.
That should be. If you want to come to Bucktown, you stop here.
So that's why
he was at the Hammer.
At the Hammer. The Hammer will drop here. He's so good. So that's why he was there in the first place. And he said something interesting, which was he attributes the downfall of Italian genre cinema to their overemphasis on, you know, attempting to mimic American movies instead of utilizing the creative talent that they possessed. And I think that's so encapsulating of what we're talking about here, because this movie exists to be a mashup, to be a ripoff. But within itself, there's a lot of creativity. There's a lot of artistry going on. There's a lot of things that should be impressing people beyond its roots, beyond the reason it exists in the first place.
Yeah. No, this film stands as something that you can watch with those other films and you see what was knocked, what they stole, but it's not just, it's greater than the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
And it really kind of becomes its own weird little thing. And in a way that many of the other Italian knockoffs didn't.
Yeah.
And that's what I think Castellari mostly gets right. Now I disagree. You know, I think his follow up to this, and now I'm blanking on which title actually proved to be the right.
Warriors of the Wasteland.
Warriors of the Wasteland isn't good.
No, it's not. It has a lot of elements that are kind of fun to behold, but you're right. It is not a good movie. The guy from the paper chase is no trash. And I can't believe that I'm actually saying this, but Robert Ginty will never be as attractive a hero in a lot of ways. I'm okay with it. Then, you know, Mark Gregory is in this film, and
Mark Gregory was never as Mark Gregory as he was in this film.
That's it. We've established from the changes that were made before he appeared in the second film. But yeah, in the Vic Morrow, we touched on Vic Morrow being that Vic Morrow is another one of my favorite actors, and this movie was actually the last thing he finished before he went to work on Twilight Zone. So it takes on this kind of...
Oh, fuck.
I know. And if you guys aren't familiar, Vic Morrow died tragically as the result of an accident on the set of The Twilight Zone during John Landis's vignette of the film. And so this became sort of the last movie that he had finished before that happened. And what's so fitting about it, as weird as it sounds to think that a great actor like Vic Morrow, his last completed film would be something like 1990 Bronx Warriors, he was born in the Bronx. Vic Morrow is an actor from the Bronx, and his last completed movie is him playing a villain in a movie called 1990 Bronx Warriors that is shot half in New York and half in Italy and partially in Brooklyn, I guess, from time to time. But
with a badass drummer.
With a badass.
And that scene in particular you're talking about, that shot where we see the drummer and all the bikes lined up is just so – it's just there's so much – there's so many masterful – elements in this film that just highlight, it's clear they're going for weird. It's clear they're going for that. And it's, I don't think it's sad that this is Vic Morrow's final film that was completed. The Twilight Zone thing,
it's heartbreaking.
It gets me every time I think about it.
Heartbreaking.
There's so much. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that story, but familiarize yourself with that story if you're not, because there's so much. It's such a weird, tragic story where Morrow and those two little girls died shooting this scene, and it destroyed Landis's career. You know, Landis was hot shit, and it destroyed his career, destroyed him. The only thing good to come from him after that was his son. Max Landis, the screenwriter, he tried, he worked on several other things. There's a documentary he did that was kind of good, but yeah, we're, this is sidestepping.
Tangential
as hell, but yeah, no, it's a story you got to read. Cause there's some, you feel bad for Landis. And at the same time, it seems like Landis might be very responsible for what happened. But yeah, Vic Morrow is good in this too.
Yeah.
Like he's it's clear he was, there's some actors in this profession that end up in a lot of shitty movies.
Hmm.
And a lot of film snobs like to throw barbs at people like, Sam Jackson and, Michael Caine, and guys of those ilk who just will show up in anything.
Yeah.
And they just don't care.
It was the way Jude Law was for a while. Jude Law went through a period literally where he was doing 4 to 5 movies every single year.
Yeah, but I think he was wanted to do those. It wasn't like these guys where you could call up Sam Jackson and if you pay him the right amount, he will show up.
You're saying they were doing it for the paychecks.
Well, they are, and that's the criticism that they get, but they're both guys who, like, especially, you know, Michael Caine, he was the son of a coal miner. And his dad got up every day and went into the coal mine. So he was going to be damned if he was going to take a day off because, well, I don't like the work as much as I like some of the other stuff. And he's one of those actors who felt you keep working, you keep taking jobs, and eventually you're going to get those jobs that you love and you really enjoy. But sometimes you're going to have to do the other stuff. But you're always going to get Michael Caine.
Right.
And you're always going to get Sam Jackson. When you hire Sam Jackson, you get him. It doesn't matter if it's a remake of RoboCop. You're still going to get Sam Jackson, and he's going to show up, and he's going to give you his all. And Vic Morrow was one of those guys. Vic Morrow, I don't remember a role in which Vic Morrow sleepwalked through the movie.
Yeah.
Like he was, even if it was, what is this, 1990s Bronx Warriors? Fuck it. They're getting Vic Morrow. And it that kind of shows through in this movie.
Vic Morrow was always an actor that I was exposed to because my dad was a big fan of the show Combat. So I used to watch reruns of Combat with my dad. So I grew up knowing who Vic Morrow was. And I remember one of the things that made me the happiest when I discovered this film was like, holy shit, it's got Fred Williamson and Vic Morrow? And they're both used so well. And Vic Morrow is just such a badass hitman in this movie. And lending again to kind of the social commentary of the film, he's a hitman who's also an NYPD cop. So this movie, like a lot of dystopian fiction, is very mistrusting of authority. It's very mistrusting of literally the police state, which is what they've kind of created here. And I think, again, this just goes back to how much smarter this movie is than anybody will probably ever give it credit for.
Yeah.
And also, one really weird tidbit about this movie that always made me happy, the Hell's Angels were part of the fucking stunt team. The Hell's Angels were hired to be stuntmen on this movie. I mean, the Italians only ever cared about getting the movie made, not trivial things like perfect technique or safe filming environments. We have the Hell's Angels. They're going to be stuntmen because this movie takes place on motorcycles. So there you have it. But yeah, I highly recommend, if you've never seen a single Italian post-apocalyptic film, I feel like this is the one that will probably be the easiest to find. And this is the one that you should really cut your teeth on because it is – I think it's the best.
Yeah. I don't know if there's any legal copies for sale out there right now. I don't know what the rights are. I know you got me a copy on DVD that was put out by Braun Media, the mega corporation Braun Media.
Well, Brains Media didn't have it, so
and it's clearly one of those cheap as hell, you know, listed as a classic.
Yeah,
that you know it was, you know, probably designed for video stores at the end of the video store era. But
well, there's a much better DVD by Shriek Show that I just didn't get you because I'm cheap. So if you want to seek that out, that is available on DVD. They also have a post-apocalyptic collection that you can buy from Shriek Show that not only has 1990 Bronx Warriors, but indeed also contains After the Fall of New York and The New Barbarians. So you get all three of those movies in one shot. Now that is
a badass Sunday afternoon.
It is. It's and that set is unfortunately out of print, but you can get it from private sellers on Amazon. I highly recommend that. But,
and well, that's what I was wondering. If it's out of print, then that explains why it's also there's a beautiful version of it streaming on YouTube.
Ah, there you have it.
YouTube. So
not that we endorse that kind of thing.
Well, if it's out of print and somebody's put it on YouTube and it's been like this copy that I saw has been on there for over a year.
Yeah.
Then there's nobody looking to pull it down. then, you know, I'm never against that kind of stuff. You know,
I was just trying to cover our ass legally, but apparently we totally endorse this.
No. Hey, look, if they hear it and go, hey, they're pointing towards YouTube, they can file the complaint and it will be yanked down if it's not legal. But if it's one of those things where the rights are up in the air, nobody has the rights, or the person who has the rights just doesn't give a shit about it. And you know what? No, fuck it. It's the Italians. They stole these movies.
They stole their own fucking movies.
Fucking, you know, we're taking it back.
They took back their own movies. I love that. That is fantastic. Well, enjoy this movie, and why not enjoy a nice slice of Olive Garden tiramisu? Because if the Italians are going to rip off the things that America does well, then why not enjoy something where America tries and fails ripping off something that Italians do well? And that is pretty much everything the Olive Garden puts out. So,
now we're going to get a letter.
Now we're going to get a letter from the giant Olive Garden conglomerate that listens to our podcast.
Oh, no. I was from people who actually would go to Olive Garden and be like, why did you send me? I thought you were actually recommending. I wasn't even thinking. They make really good virgin pina coladas. I was confused.
Yeah.
1990, the Bronx Warriors. The first to die will be the lucky ones.
Well, thank you once again for joining us on Junk Food Cinema. I hope you've had a good time talking about 1990 Bronx Warriors. And about ironic film appreciation and non-ironic film appreciation. It's been a good show overall, I'd say.
I think it was.
That's good. Thanks for the backup on that. I appreciate it. Well, I am Brian Salisbury. You can find me here on Film School Rejects. This show, obviously, will be out every week. You can also follow me on Twitter, at BryGuySalisbury. You can follow the show on Twitter, at Junk Food Cinema, all one word. Cargill, how about you? Where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me at twitter.com/massaworm or on Facebook, facebook.com/massaworm. You can also find my book in stores right now, Dreams and Shadows, which is, I don't know when this is posted, but between March 3rd and March 17th, it'll be on sale digitally for $1.99.
Go pick that up.
As a ramp up to the release of its sequel, Queen of the Dark Things, which comes out May 13th.
I don't like to praise this guy a lot because it gives him a big head, but that is one supremely written piece of fiction, and something you're getting it for $1.99. That's a goddamn steal. So definitely pick that up. And until next time, we're going to keep watching and keep eating, because I mean, that's pretty much all we do at this point. That's